Howdy, Ags. Welcome to Aggie Growth Hacks, the podcast sponsored by the McFerrin Center for Entrepreneurship at Texas A&M that is dedicated to helping entrepreneurs improve their business, connect with other Aggie entrepreneurs, and support one another. I'm your host, Greg Martin, Fighting Texas Aggie Class of 2001.
And I'm your co-host, Chris Hunter, Fighting Texas Aggie Class of 1998.
Woo! Well, Ags, we're into year four in season eight of Aggie Growth Hacks, and we are bursting with great conversations with Aggies and a few non-Aggies. We're going to start this season off with a discussion of one of the best entrepreneurs that Chris and I know. Mike McCallows is an entrepreneur, best-selling author, keynote speaker, podcaster, and all-around great guy. Mike is actually one of the reasons that Aggie Growth Hacks even exists, as it was through his view and insight on entrepreneurship that Chris and I initially bonded. Mike's not an Aggie, but he did attend a fellow senior military college, Virginia Tech, and he has just launched a book, All In, where he explores how great leaders build unstoppable teams. Over the last 4 years, we have heard from just about every single guest that without a strong team, a business is nothing. So we thought that we would kick off season eight with someone that has literally written the book on how to create a team that is all in.
So pass it back and listen up to Mike as he shares some good bull.
Mike, thank you so much for joining us. We are beyond stoked to have you with us today to kick off season eight of Aggie Growth Hacks and Roofer Growth Hacks. Let's just dive into it. You have written another amazing book. So tell us all about All In. Why'd you write it? What did you learn from it? And what can we learn from you?
So I got to share one thing. This first is I had my first. I went to a Texas A&M game this year. As you all beat up on Ole Miss, and I think you fired your coach right after, which
okay, was, Mississippi State.
Oh, Mississippi State was
That's right. Win again, fire coach.
Crushed Mississippi State. And as I was driving out, like, oh, coach got fired. I'm like, oh, okay.
Well, did you happen to notice the $126 million check that was donated to the university at halftime, and then he was fired? Sure there was no coincidence.
No coincidence. I never seen so many cheers in my life. Everyone knew every cheer and the gestures and all this stuff going on. It was the coolest thing. And maybe that speaks a little bit to All In. So the new book is called All In. In part, it's about those cultures, those environments where everyone's on board. Everyone gets the environment. Everyone performs at the highest level. One thing that was interesting is started about 5 years ago, I started researching out All In. And I started to, when I do a speaking engagement, asking audiences who in the room was an A player. And it's one of my favorite questions to ask because you won't be surprised. I mean, everyone considers himself an A player. So, you know, all the hands go up, and we define A player by loyal and committed, driven, perform the best level that you can and so forth. And then I'd say to the same audience, and sometimes hundreds, sometimes thousands in the room, I'd say, what percentage of the population are A players? And then the responses are like, 5%, 10% max, 2%. I'm like, isn't this interesting? Everyone in this room is an A player, 100%.
We're all here.
We all came here. And so I said, either it's a statistical anomaly, like this is some kind of weird thing going on, or there's something askew. And the reality is, I believe, I've concluded, everyone is an A player in the right environment. I call it A potential. You can pick any human being on this planet. If you put them in the right environment for what they have the talent at, they will excel there. Maybe you have some dude that is really a big time sleeper, the laziest person on the planet, maybe great at testing beds and finding the most comfortable bed. Like, we just have to match up the person. I'm not saying that your organization, Greg or Chris or my organization, has a role for everybody, but everyone is an A player in the right environment. We just have to discern who that person is. And if they're a match for us, then allow them to develop within our organization.
So how do you assess if everyone's the A player, how do you find that right role for that right person?
Yep. I got a Texas A&M story. They know how to do it. And actually, admittedly, most college football programs and most pro programs do this extraordinarily well. I was looking at how do you find extraordinary talent and found there's this near $1 trillion industry, sports, that do this. And what you do is they run camps. Now, let's compare it to what most businesses do. Most businesses do interviews. I need a X person. I run the ad. 3 or 4 people come in and I interview. And after frustration, say, oh my God, this is the best of the worst. I'll hire them. Could you imagine Texas A&M doing that? Saying, hey, we need a new quarterback. Let's interview 3 or 4 guys. No. What they do is camps. And what a camp is when you're in eighth grade or you're starting high school, you get invited to camp. Now they have, 400 or 500 athletes there. Every athlete is then given skills, techniques, and all of them are being trained. So everyone's actually elevating. But during that process, the coaches are also observing, who's showing the most desire and thirst, the most potential? Those kids are tapped on the shoulder and said, hey, we got another field we'd like to take you to try more skills and so forth. It's a vetting process at the same time. What's beautiful about these camps is everyone gets better, but the cherry-picked ones are the ones that are the best fit for your organization because they demonstrated it. I've experienced this myself. I played sports in high school. I played lacrosse. I went to a camp in the northeast of the States, and I didn't get tapped on the shoulder, but some of the kids did, and they played for Hobart, was the university. I got good enough, though, to play in college, and I was a college athlete because of that camp. So the beautiful thing is everyone elevates, and you get to cherry pick who you want for your organization. As an employer, we can do the exact same thing. Run workshops. I need to hire a bookkeeper. Run a bookkeeping workshop. You don't know how to teach bookkeeping? That's fine. Hire an expert to teach bookkeeping. But the people who show up, A, are interested in bookkeeping. Secondly, you can then find the people who have the desire and thirst and cherry pick them. The last thing I want to share about this, this isn't just like theory. Businesses do this. Home Depot, next time you see Home Depot runs an ad, like, you know, come down and build a birdhouse with your kid. Watch all the parents and guardians that show up there with their kids. They'll be assembling the birdhouse. There's an employee at Home Depot observing the participation of those parents to see who's the most participative, who has the most desire to learn and share, who's helping others. They tap those people on the shoulder and say, hey, we'd love to have someone like you at Home Depot. You ever consider working here full or part-time? It's a recruiting platform.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty awesome. So tell us a little bit about what all in really means. What you went through a lot in your book, and what's the formula in everything? I mean, how do you get that all together into a formula to hire and recruit the right people?
Yeah, ultimately, I do a formula. I call it FASO. There's the fit, the ability, the safety, and the ownership elements that need to be addressed. So I'll touch on some, but I'll deep dive in a couple. So fit is most organizations simply say, we have this role or this title of receptionist that needs to be filled. Let's interview for receptionist. What great organizations and great leaders do is they break down a title into individual tasks. And I'll say, basically, I need to find a person or people to fill these individual tasks. Titles are very siloing. Tasks can be matched up with people's greatest talents. So that's the lesson here, is match talent to task, not to titles. Titles are very traditional, old organizational structure, results in a pyramid structure. When you match talent to task, it's more like a web-like structure, and you allow people to do what they're best at. So I'm not going to deep dive in that, but that's just the general part. Ability, we kind of touched on already, is where people have three types of abilities. Experiential, which is their history. What I've done in the past is indicative of the future. Their innate ability is like, you know, what's my internal makeup? Am I a driver or so forth? There's things like Enneagram and Myers-Briggs that help us identify that. Mm-hmm. And then there's potential ability. Great companies, great leaders look for potential. And the best way to do it is through demonstration, which is workshops, camps. Those camps, run these workshops where people can demonstrate their ability. Then there's safety. And safety is where people feel physically safe, emotionally safe, relationship safe. They feel that they're being cared for. And I think this is where I want to deep dive a little bit. Most organizations, Chris, will say, hey, we have a corporate vision. We're going to achieve X million dollars in revenue, or we're going to achieve XYZ. That vision is not the vision of the organization. It's a vision of an individual, the owner of the organization, or the leadership team. But every single employee didn't sit there and say, we want to do $10 million. You may have one employee says, I want to actually spend time with my family this year, or I want to buy my first house, or I want to learn play guitar. Everyone has their own individual visions. Great leaders identify what everyone's personal vision is and makes it a priority to help them navigate toward that vision. So what I do is I meet with my team and say every year, and we actually have can't see it on the screen here, but there's a board I have set up here that has my individual dreams and visions, and all my colleagues have it outside my office here. And we say, what do you want to achieve? Then my job is to help them achieve their personal visions on the path to our corporate vision, which is mine. Mm-hmm. And when people feel supported in achieving their visions, reciprocity kicks in. They want to support mine. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite stories, it's in the book, is a janitorial company called Jancoa. I interviewed Mary Miller. She's the co-founder of the company. They have 600 janitors. And the first thing Mary said when I talked to her on the phone, she goes, Mike, no one's ever dreamed of being a janitor. Like, that's not a dream. But she goes, but everyone has dreams. So that they do is every week, they sit down in small cells. There's maybe 5 to 10 of them, a pocket of people, you know, they get together and they say, what are your dreams? What's your visions? How are you doing on that? Are you learning to play guitar? One gentleman who I interviewed didn't know how to read or write. And he said, he had a granddaughter. He's like, I want to be able to read nighttime bedtime stories to my granddaughter. So they helped him get on the educational path. The interesting thing too is Jankowicz doesn't pay for your dreams. People don't like to be gifted dreams as much as achieve dreams. But they kept him on the path. They gave that guy flexibility to go to the education. And sure enough, 6 months later, he was able to read his first bedtime story to his granddaughter. And it was transformative for his family. It was transformative for him. And his loyalty to the company further escalated. He's like, this company cares about who I am. It's no surprise they're one of the best janitorial companies. They're in the Cincinnati area, but hands down in their territory because they have such high performance. The retention rate is extraordinary because they care for their people first. So that's one of the key formulas is we have to identify our team's dreams and align it with the corporate vision.
So then how does that tie into ownership? Because as my dream as an employee may not be the corporate dream.
Right.
But at the end of the day, we're all employers. We hire people to do stuff for what we design our company for. You know, I mean, that's why we exist.
Yeah.
So how does helping someone, how do you connect those two things that seem to be not connectable at all?
Yeah. One of the lines I hear most frequently is like, gosh, I wish my employees would act like owners, right? I wish they'd have ownership in the company.
Give them ownership then.
Right. Well, one technique is give ownership. But here's what's so funny is what I found is ownership without what's called psychological ownership. So legal ownership, where they have a piece of the company, without psychological ownership actually works against us in most cases. It forms entitlement. I own a piece of the business now. Where's my profitability? You owe me. Yeah. So many ESOPs are deployed inappropriately because they focus on the legal ownership. They don't focus on psychological ownership. But here's the other flip side. You don't have to give legal ownership. If you simply deploy psychological ownership, people will have their identity in link with the company and perform at their highest levels. Identity is the ultimate thermometer. We achieve who we believe we are. And so if we believe that the company is mine in part, even if it's not legally, I'll act that way. So first question is, how do you achieve ownership psychologically? There's three components. One is when someone has intimate knowledge of their responsibilities. So the more we know about something, the more we feel we own it. The second thing is when we have the ability to personalize it, when it can be made mine. I can put little elements of it. And third is that we have control over it. We can give it direction. One of my favorite examples is with cars because it's so apparent. There's two scenarios. You can rent a car, you can own a car. A rental car, we're given explicit instructions of how we have to behave. Return with a full tank of gas or you'll get penalized. You know, no scratches or dents, of course, and then a clean interior. And they take all this information from you to ensure that you're going to comply. And I have a saying, when we're forced to comply, we will seek to defy. It's human nature. The more constraint pushed on us, the more we're going to push back out. So I don't know how you guys are, but when I leave that, I consider it like a DMZ, when you give your license for the 15th time and the lights flash and the gate goes up and the spikes go down. The second I leave that DMZ, I floor it. I skid into lights. I punch it the second it turns green in my little Ford Fiesta, whatever I'm driving. I'll abuse the crap out of that car. The reason is because it ain't mine. And they've given me such explicit control that I'm going to get back at the man. Well, that's what most employers do. Here's your job. You fail to do this, you'll be punished. You have to perform here. You're going to be measured on this. We're going to be tracking. You better do it. Force to comply, we'll seek to defy. Now, the other side is psychological ownership. You guys may own a car. I own a car, but I actually don't even really own it. The bank owns it. I got it recently. I'm making my bank payments. So legally, I don't own the car, but psychologically, I do. So my behavior is radically different. I don't abuse the car. After I do a long drive, I'll actually pat it on the dashboard. I notice, nice job.
Good job.
Yeah, good job. Yeah. It sounds crazy, but there's three elements playing. First, I have control. I decide where I take it, when I take it, where I park it. I have control if it goes out today or not. It's mine. The rental car, there's constraints. Can't take it out of the country. You got to return on such and such day. You know, my car can do whatever I want when I want. I can personalize it. I can slap bumper stickers on it. I can put dice in the mirror. Don't do that with your rental car. You can't do that. I have intimate knowledge. I know how every button is. I can program the radio buttons to be my stations. You don't have that in a rental car. You don't know what half the buttons do. So the car that we own, we have those three elements going on. Therefore, it becomes significant to us. With our employees, give your employees within their realm of responsibility the ability to have ownership, meaning that they can control direction of something. You agree to the outcomes, but they can control the path. Give them the ability to personalize it. How can they make it more of their own? Allow them to gain intimate knowledge. You do that, psychological ownership sets in. When you start hearing them say, oh, this is my job. This is our company. Those are all words of psychological ownership. If you hear them saying, this is your company, or this is the job, they don't have that psychological ownership yet.
So how do you make that switch then? You know, if you've got an employee that is like that, how do you, because I know that it all comes from us as leaders to start that process, right? And I know in one of your chapters, you talked about good boss versus bad boss. How do we become that good boss? How do we get those employees to get that ownership, you know, in their mind?
Yeah. I guess the little rhyme is start slow and let it grow. One of the stories I share in All In is a barbecue house in Texas. It's a barbecue smokehouse owned by a guy named Stephen King. Not that Stephen King, it just happens to be the same name. It was kind of funny interviewing Stephen King. And he hired his employee named Joel, who was a C player, and C could be cancerous, like just a bad employee from the get-go. The only reason he even hired this guy was because a friend said that Joel couldn't find a job. Would Stephen do him a favor and just hire this guy, which is, you know, not someone you should hire. Well, what he did was when Stephen showed up, he was filthy, covered with grease, all this stuff. He needed someone to be a waiter. And Joel also showed up about 3 hours late, first day of employment. So Steve's like, go back, clean up. You're going to get one more shot. Come on time. The guy comes back. He's not much better. By the end of the week, he wants to fire him. He keeps him for one more week, but deploys psychological ownership. And what he did was he started slow. He went to Steve on week two and said, to Joel. He goes, hey, listen, there's a bar we have in our smokehouse here, and there's this box of straws. And what frustrates me as the owners, when someone pulls the straws out, they kind of explode everywhere and people leave the straws. I want you to own the straw box. The outcome I like us to see is just a neat, organized box, but you determine how you want to manage it, how you want to do it. You've control. So what he's allowing Stephen to do was put his own control around it, to personalize it, maybe make it his own way. He gave him that sense of authority. And you won't be surprised with that specificity, that small amount, Joel was able to do it. And actually did a pretty good job. It was always organized because it was something that was unique to him now. Well, after a few more days, Joel was approached by Steve and said, hey, you want to handle the bar mats too? They're always filthy with beer suds and so forth. And Joel's like, yeah. Well, this continued on. Joel's performance improved, not just in those areas, but all areas, because he started having authority over something. Fast forward 2 years later, Joel's the number one performing employee at the company. He's an A player by far. He manages the entire front end of the restaurant. I called Joel and I said, dude, admittedly, you know, you were not performing well. And now look at you, you're a rock star. What happened? And the guy starts tearing up. And I start tearing up and thinking about it. He goes, Mike, you don't know my background. He's like, I was abused as a kid. My parents told me I'd never amount to anything. I'd never own anything. This is the first place I was ever given authority over something and able to own something. He's like, I love this smokehouse. I goes, I will do anything for it. And then we continued chatting. I said, but Steve, you were showing up so filthy and stuff. I heard like you're always coming in clean and stuff now. What was that all about? He goes, oh, that grease and stuff. He goes, I love working on cars. He goes, my dream is to be a professional race car driver one day. So I'm always working on my trucks and stuff like that. And I said, Joel, the way your performance has improved and how you're doing, you are going to be a professional race car driver. I said, it's going to be such a big loss for the smokehouse. And then Joel chuckled and he goes, I'm never leaving the smokehouse. He's like, I'm going to be a professional race car driver and work at the smokehouse. I was like, this is amazing, man. This is so amazing. What happened was reciprocity. He was giving ownership over something very small, but over time was able to develop that. And then he took ownership, emotional ownership within the company. And now is an A player by far.
Well, Mike, this is an area that we have talked to in the last 100 or so episodes about entrepreneurs and how difficult it is to build the team, to attract the right people.
Yeah.
What I'm hearing you say, and this is kind of going back to clockwork and some of the other things, the primary job of an owner needs to be pouring into and growing and providing the fit, ability, safety, and ownership of the team. Because if you don't do that,
you're right.
What is there?
Yeah, you got to pour into your people. My own companies that I own, obviously when I'm writing my books, I'm also testing it out in my own business. I deploy this stuff. I ran a survey of this office right here. This is our author office. There's eight of us, itty bitty company. And I went to our team anonymously and said, how safe do you feel in this environment? And assuming, you know, it's not even a concern, but I should just ask anyway. Couldn't believe how many people came back and said, the alley, there's an alleyway that goes by the side entrance of our building, feels unsafe. It's pitch black. The sun sets here around 5:30 in the wintertime. And when I'm leaving the office at 5 or 6 o'clock at night, I'm a little afraid. Like, who's in that alley? So what we did is we installed string lights. And now it's super bright. But what the consequence was, before I knew this, my colleagues around 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon are like, gosh, I have to leave the office in a couple of hours. It's going to be black, dark. They start getting concerned, and their work performance, I assume, had to be dropping because they were concerned for their safety. So to your point, Greg, as great leaders pour into their colleagues, they love upon them. They block and tackle for them. And it's just natural reciprocity. Our colleagues will reciprocate and care for the company the way we care for them.
I love that. Absolutely love that. Well, Mike, thank you so much for coming on to the podcast here. I mean, it's just, you don't understand how much this means to both Greg and I.
Thanks, guys.
You know, it's just so cool. I'm geeking out because you're here, you know, just on the same place with you. I want to take screenshots and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, but, you rock, brother.
Man, thank you so much for coming on. We really, really appreciate that.
Chris, this has been a joy being with you, Greg, being with you. Thank you so much for having me, guys.
Well, how about that, Ags? Was that pretty freaking amazing or what? I mean, I'm geeking out here about having Mike Michalowicz on Aggie Growth Hacks. It just blows my mind that someone that I've followed over the years and someone I've read every single one of his books, you know, actually came on the podcast. I got to talk with him, you know, I mean, face to face here and almost face to face, you know, on Zoom. But I mean, come on, this is pretty cool. Dude, it was rapid fire, but I was just writing, you know, and I've got a ton of takeaways here. What's your biggest ones there, Greg?
I don't know if I can nail it down to just one. The two that really struck me, and they struck me in the book as well as in the conversation. The first one was the components of the psychological ownership and how he talked about you've got to have very clear knowledge of the responsibilities, communicating that to your employees, and trusting them enough to give them control over the outcome. And then that will lead to their ownership of that. And through that ownership, that's when you're going to get additional effort. You're going to get those A players, the ones that go above and beyond. You know, he like one of the examples he talked about in his book is with his team. He has a part-time lady that was having some logistical problems with like books getting shipped to the office.
Yeah.
So she's just like, well, just ship into my house.
Yeah.
And then I'll bring them in.
And she's part-time, right?
Part-time. And this is someone that is now, at the very least, is having to go through and load them into her car and then get them into the office. But he talked about how they actually, on the weekend, her husband and her kids, they took their personal time and invested into the company to be able to solve a company problem. That is psychological ownership. So I mean, I love that. And I would just, you know, I'm sure you were thinking too, I mean, how many times did we have that type of structure in the military?
Yeah.
You know, like when we had a section or a group or something that we were in charge of, the psychological ownership of that. The second thing was that everyone is an A player in the right environment. Yeah, but then I love how he also followed it up as saying, but I'm not saying that you have to have a place for every person.
Right.
You have to be really tough, and you have to really say, okay, you may be the world's best bed tester. Mm-hmm. Well, we're a roofing company. We're not a bed manufacturer. Right. So I think you need to find a place that you can be an A player. And I need someone that isn't a roofer. So I love that. What about you? What were your nuggets? I mean, I wouldn't even say takeaway.
Yeah. Well, I think the biggest one to me was when he said, start slow and let it grow. Right. And what he meant by that was give, and he gave the example of the employee that was not doing so good. You know, I mean, he was a C player, right? He wasn't even a B player and was coming into work late, was not showing up, you know, dressed for the job, right? And was dirty. And so he started giving them small tasks, right? And giving him ownership of those tasks, you know? He gave the example of the straws. And then next, he gave him another task, and then another one, and then another one. And all of a sudden, years later, this guy is his best employee, right? Because he's got that extreme ownership in the company there. I think that's one of my biggest takeaways there was, you know, start slow and let it grow. Other ones, I 100% agree with you. I mean, you know, having ownership is different for people that own their own companies and getting their employees to have ownership in the company without actually giving them legal ownership, right? He made a big distinction about that. And matching that talent to task, you know, and making sure that and this goes back to EOS, is having the right person in the right seat, really, is what it comes down to. And having the core tasks, right, really identified for that and fitting that person into that role. So I love it. Absolutely loved this entire interview. It was, I could talk with Mike probably for hours, I'm pretty sure, you know?
100%. Yeah, I wish he would have let us know that he was in Aggieland. That would have been awesome. But what about the workshops that he was talking about?
Oh, yeah.
I was just trying to think through, okay, in my business as a fractional CFO, you know, he's like, okay, you know, having a bookkeeper or having someone that walks people through audits or some type of forecasting. It would be a little bit of work, but you know what? I think that it could be something that you can kind of put a, for lack of a better term, a case study together.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, now this would, so if Chris, if I gave you a whole, you know, 3 years of profit and loss, some information on a company and said, okay, give me a pro forma, you'd probably jab yourself in the eye and be like, hell no, that's not it. But honestly, that's, isn't that also part of the process?
Yeah.
You know, saying, okay, self-selecting people out that don't just want a job, but someone that are jazzed up and let's nerd out on Excel, you know?
Yeah.
But how would you, and I know, and we're just riffing here, but that was something that was really, is like, okay, that makes a lot of sense, but man, that's an investment, right?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And any small business, that's going to be hard task to do, you know? But when you get into a little bit bigger companies that can make that investment, you know, like Home Depot, he gave the example of Home Depot and how they have workshops there.
Yeah. I want to go see if I can get a Home Depot job now.
Right. Exactly. Right. They come and tap you on the shoulder if you're good at making birdhouses or whatever that it is. Right.
I probably won't get tapped. It'd be like, no. Dude, no. I'll make that for you. You're fine. You just put the screwdriver down. It's okay, sir.
Right.
Walk away.
Yeah. Maybe you're not fit for this job here, right? To implement that for a small business, you know, not quite sure about that. I think that you would have to have some resources to be able to, you know, put into something like that. But it's possible, highly possible, you could get with other small businesses and run a workshop that way.
Oh, right?
And pool your resources together with other small businesses that aren't competitors, obviously, but you know, people that are like-minded, they're looking for the same things, right? A bookkeeper, let's say, or sales staff, right? You know, and I mean, you could pull those resources together to make that reality.
I mean, think about it, like going back to his sports camp analogy, you know, when Elk goes out there this summer at 300 degrees and it's, you know, come to the Mike Elko, football camp experience, and they're bringing in from seventh grade to seniors. Yeah. It's all about identifying who that is. And to take your example, you know, it's not just all quarterbacks. It's not just all wide receivers. It's the defensive line, the O-line, the tight ends, and to have them collectively come together with other businesses, i.e. other coaches.
Right.
Oh, man, I like that. That's brilliant. I don't know how we're going to get it done, but that's brilliant.
Well, Ags, you heard it here first. So, you know, contact Greg and I, and we'll try to figure it out. Maybe get with Jose Quintana about that one.
What did he say? Find somebody and outsource it. Jose would do much better at that than we would. So, yes, Jose, absolutely. If you're listening, be looking, pick up when we call.
That's right.
Well, Ags, that's going to do it for this episode of Aggie Growth Hacks. We are so excited about season 8. And Chris and I want to tell you a little bit logistically about what's going on. It's a little bit different. So as you know, or if you've listened to Aggie Growth Hacks at all, in the last 7 months, I have stepped away from my bank W-2 job and I've started my own company. And so now I'm actually starting to feel the pain of, hey, you know what? Your time is not yours. Or I haven't structured my time to be able to have that 4-hour work week yet. As a result, we're not gonna be able to interview as many Ags and to bring them on to new episodes of Aggie Growth Hacks. So during this season, we're gonna drop a new episode every single week. But then on the off weeks, we're gonna go and we're gonna recycle some of our old ones. Ags, we got over 100 great conversations. Mm-hmm. And so we're going to keep it fresh. So make sure that you tune in every single week for new episodes and historical episodes. But we want to let you know, hey, we're being open and honest with y'all. This is entrepreneurship. We adapt and overcome. And right now, it's important that Chris and I both invest into our day jobs so that we can continue to do this passion of love. We appreciate you understanding that. We appreciate the grace, but we also would love to continue to also learn about you and have your story. So if you're looking to maybe get on and highlight yourself, highlight your team, we would love to connect with you. While you're on the web, make sure that you connect with Aggie Growth Hacks, connect with Chris, connect with me, and give this episode a huge thumbs up, shout it out, post it, make sure you tag us, make sure you tag Mike Michalowicz, because I know that the value that he's brought to this community, either directly through us or indirectly through us, has been so valuable.
We want to give a huge shout out to our sponsor, the McFerrin Center for Entrepreneurship at Texas A&M University. Since 1999, the McFerrin Center for Entrepreneurship has served as the hub for entrepreneurship at Texas A&M. If you're an Aggie entrepreneur or even a wantrepreneur, head on over to their website to find a program that's right for you. Just go to aggiegrowthhacks.com/McFerrin right now. Well, Ags, join us next time when we connect with another great Aggie entrepreneur and learn how they hacked their growth. Until then, I'm Chris Hunter.
And I'm Greg Martin. Thanks and gig 'em.
Whoop.